Hello, I'm Gregory Novak. This is The Cunning of Geist, episode 75. Welcome back. The purpose of the podcast is to explore philosophy, psychology, and modern science in an effort to examine current societal issues so the status quo is not blindly accepted and listeners can realize their own power and potential to make productive change in the world. In this episode, I intend to show how philosophy underlies all the major areas of life, including how we organize ourselves, the rules and laws we live by, our scientific worldview, and the morals that we hold up today. And this is an important topic because many still seem to consider philosophy just a meaningless exercise. That is because many philosophical statements cannot be proven in a scientific laboratory. And to some, it just seems that what philosophers do is just redefine certain concepts for the sake of redefining and nothing else. A brain game, if you will, with no real practical application. But hold on, not so fast. What I'm going to attempt to show in this episode is that far from being a meaningless exercise, philosophical positions underlie each and every one of the major institutions of our life today. This includes government, our laws, science, and morality itself. As you will see, that is a lot to cover. But before we begin, let me address one point. I understand that I have a relatively selective audience here with the Cunning of Geist podcast. Now, some of you know this began as an outgrowth of my work as an administrator of the Hegel Study Group on Facebook. And I believe the success and the growth of that group, which we've grown from just a few hundred members initially to over 30,000 today, has been largely due to taking a more approachable path to his philosophy, Hegel's philosophy, putting his exceedingly complicated systems into everyday language that an average person with average intelligence could understand. And the audience has been built up far beyond just the academic community of philosophers. In general, it's been geared towards seekers, for lack of a better term. And I've attempted to take that same tone, that same balance here on the Cunning of Geist podcast. And it has worked. The last time I checked, this podcast has reached over 45,000 downloads. That's an average of over 600 downloads per episode. And when I say seekers, I mean those that are curious about big questions in life. And PhDs can be included in this category as well. And my feeling is that many today are frustrated with what they've learned in school, or I should say what they haven't learned in school, and what is out there in the media. And they hunger for more. They feel there must be more to life than just getting by. Now, I know not everyone is a seeker. There are those that are content in their knowledge base and are satisfied with how life is treating them. And these folks may not be interested in what I'm covering here, and that's okay. But for those that are interested in ideas and what some of the greatest thinkers have said on important issues and how there is a commonality across many different silos of study and how these connections can be applied to one's life in terms of actionable steps one can take, well, then this podcast is targeted to that segment of the population. And I recognize that we're talking about a spectrum here. Not everybody falls into seeker or non-seeker, a binary choice. There's a large percentage of folks who fall somewhere in between. And I believe that many of the people in between do have a spark of inquiry that can be ignited within them through exposure to new ways of thinking. And in particular, this can be accomplished with people that just haven't closed the doors of their mind and they're open to some new truth and knowledge, or at least a different way to think about things. And I hope to reach these people as well. Now, I recently had some interesting conversations with friends and family members, a couple that I would not consider them seekers, but the feedback I got was, "Greg, we're so happy that you're doing this podcast. We've tried to listen to it, but having difficulty understanding it, particularly because some of the words you use we're unfamiliar with. There's a certain uncertainty as how the topics discussed have any bearing on their own lives." Now, I hear that and I get that. And as I said, the podcast is not for everybody, but I think if somebody wants to come in with an open mind, I should be trying as hard as I can to reach that person. And so providing better definitions is an area that I'll definitely work on in future episodes so people don't become confused. Also, this whole issue of what practical benefit does the podcast offer? Is it just an intellectual exercise like playing chess or doing Wordle? No, I realize this is also something I have to work on to accomplish in each and every episode. I need to ensure that there's practical, real-world applications for what I'm talking about. So I'm recommitting myself to make sure every episode addresses a topic and that the terms that I use are understandable. Now, there may be times when I have to refer back to a previous episode that I've covered it in more detail, but I'll try to be as clear as I can. So with that out of the way, let me get into the topic of this episode. In thinking about this new objective of mine, I started thinking about, well, what are some of the practical benefits of philosophy? How is it used in the real world? And I was quickly surprised to see how it underlies virtually every important area of society. And many people are unaware of this. Now, I decided to take a top-down approach for this episode and look at some of our major institutions and to see how philosophers had formed some of the thinking behind the greatest fields of how we organize ourselves collectively. And that includes politics, law, science, and morality. And quite literally, these systems are not just interesting talking points, but they're actually a matter of life and death for an individual. And I plan to go into this. For example, the political state can send or not send its citizens to war. It can establish laws and punishments that include the death penalty. The law can establish just what constitutes life in the first place and whether an abortion is legal or not, or when it can occur. Science has created weapons of mass destruction that were unthinkable 200 years ago, and their use is decided by the political state. And our moral beliefs are often used in determining just what is a crime and what is appropriate punishment. And there's so many other things that touch on life and death issues. So what I want to do is go into each of these areas a bit. And it's important that people understand that you just don't have to accept these positions. You're in a position where if you're alive in the world today, you can work to change or modify them as necessary to make the world a better place. And as Steve Jobs, who founded Apple Computer, wrote, and let me quote Jobs here. This is pretty interesting. Quote, "When you grow up, you tend to get told that the world is the way it is. And it's your life to just live your life inside that world, not try to bash into the walls too much, try to have a nice family life, have fun, save a little money. But that's a very limited life. Life can be much broader once you discover one simple fact, and that is everything around you that you call life was made up by people that were no smarter than you. And you can change it. You can influence it. You can build your own things that other people can use. And the minute that you understand that you can poke life and something will pop out the other side, that you can change it, you can mold it, that's maybe the most important thing, is to shake off this erroneous notion that life is there and you're just going to live it in it versus embrace it, change it, improve it, make your mark upon it. I think that's very important. And however you learn that, once you learn it, you want to change life and make it better because it's kind of messed up in a lot of ways. Once you learn that, you'll never be the same again," end quote. Now, I take two takeaways from this. Number one, the so-called rules of society were made by people who are no smarter than you. I really believe that. Too many people discount themselves and say, oh, they're smarter people than me, blah, blah, blah. That's not true. And as such, if you buy that first premise, you have every right to change and improve the rules by which society organizes itself and to participate in the discussion. It's not one way or the other. Obviously, philosophy, there's a lot of debate about what's the correct course, but you can participate in that debate and help move things along in the direction you think will make things better. Now, let's get into it. The first area is political philosophy, and by this, I mean the age-old discussion of how to best arrange our collective life. That is the relation of the individual to society. And Politics became part of philosophy way back in the beginning in ancient Greece, Plato's Republic being the prime example, which he reviews the various ways a state can organize itself. It's probably his most famous work. And politics has been a part of philosophy ever since. And many leading philosophers have made substantial contributions to political thought, including Plato, Aristotle, Augustine, Aquinas, Hobbes, Locke, Hume, Hegel, and Mill. Now, we do emphasize Hegel here, and I should point out that Hegel's philosophy of right is considered a major work of political philosophy. And you can see here that philosophy is just not an effete game concerning the definition of concepts, but it involves decisions that provide an underpinning of how society should organize itself. And it has life and death consequences for its citizens and tremendous impact on individual rights. Now, I believe that you take any political view, there's a philosophical position behind it. Now, there may be many depending on what the issue is, but let me give an illustration. The role of the individual versus the collective state, and what are the trade-offs there? Well, in his philosophy of right, Hegel saw this polarity of collectivism versus individualism. And he thought that collectivism was best expressed by Plato's Republic on the one hand, and individualism best expressed by Rousseau's individual freedom on the other hand. Now, Plato in the Republic argued for the functioning of the collective state as being the only concern of how it is organized, ignoring the individual. And 18th century philosopher Jean-Jacques Rousseau wrote a lot of interesting works on freedom, and he greatly influenced the Age of Enlightenment and the French Revolution with its emphasis on individual liberty. And many scholars have pointed to Hegel's indebtedness, in fact, to Rousseau as providing the concept of objective and subjective freedom was such a big part of his encyclopedia and his philosophy of right. Subjective freedom is freedom to pursue your own personal needs and desire, and objective freedom is the social contract we create to live with others. Now, this trade-off between individual and collective has resulted in several recognized camps. First, there's traditional liberalism, old liberalism, which stresses the rights of the individual. And this is basically brought about in the Enlightenment. Secondly, you have modern liberalism with its increased emphasis towards social policies. Third is socialism, which in its purest form, communism, means central control and ownership of all production. And fourth is conservatism, which takes a dim view on social engineering and whole-scale reforms, believing that human needs and wants don't change that much and that less government involvement is usually the best approach. Now, these different positions are argued out even today. And where one stands on an issue is an expression of a political philosophy. It's not just a meaningless word game. And to fully cement this point that political philosophy has life and its consequences, one need look no further than the impact of philosopher Karl Marx. Communism, which took hold in 1917 with the Russian Revolution, produced brutal communist regimes in the 20th century, including Russia, later the Soviet Union, as well as in China, Cambodia, North Korea, Vietnam. And these communist governments committed outright genocide, extrajudicial executions, and deaths in labor camps, and also through artificially created famines. Now, estimates about in terms of how many people were killed vary. One very thorough study put it at 94 million people. Now, a lot depends on how you define the cause of death, but all scholars agree that it is a minimum of somewhere over 20 million, and some say it may approach 100 million or more. Now, it's very important to note here, this is communist governments killing their own people here. This is not a result of war with other countries, World War I or World War II. This is them killing their own people. Now, Karl Marx is often cited as one of the most influential people in all of human history, not just the most influential philosopher. And of course, we know that he was influenced as a young man greatly by Hegel. And he famously turned Hegel on his head, as Marx said, with his dialectical materialism. Now, dialectical materialism is the direct opposite of Hegel's dialectical idealism. And simply put, let me define this. Dialectical materialism believes that material circumstances shape ideas, where Hegel's dialectical idealism believes that ideas shape material consequences. Now, one distinctive philosophical belief these mass murderers had was that the end justifies the means. If the end was just, any means is acceptable, and this would include murder. Now, I know that some claim that the Soviet Union and China, that's not pure communism. Well, however, the original leaders of the communist revolution believed in the ends justify the means, even if it meant murder. Communist revolutionary Leon Trotsky wrote, quote, "A means can be justified only by its end, but the end in turn needs to be justified," end quote. So this means would include murder. And one just has to look what occurred in Russia and China. The numbers speak for themselves. Now, on a personal note, as I mentioned here a couple of times, I went to college in the late 1960s, early 1970s, when there was tremendous political upheaval in the air. And many were calling for outright revolution. Even the Beatles sang about it. And I had a few friends that were politically active on the far left side, and they were very happy that our university just hired a well-known Marxist professor. Although I was not actively political then, these friends of mine were. So I was invited to a private off-campus small get-together to meet and greet him in person when he arrived on campus. And I got to tell you, I was really shocked by what he said. He called for outright violent revolution. He called all police pigs and said it would be justified to kill any policeman or woman because they were upholding the laws of the state, which were corrupt and needed to be overthrown. And I'm not exaggerating one bit about murdering the police. I could not believe what my ears were hearing. I was in shock. This guy was aggressive. He was mean. He was insulting anyone that was not enthusiastically bobbing their head up and down in agreement. I did not say anything, but I think he could see my dismay, and he began to harass me personally. I don't recall exactly what he said, but it was something to do with, if you're not part of the solution, you're part of the problem. And he began mocking me on the assumption that I had come from a bourgeois background. Now, there were just a handful of people there, so it was pretty intense. So I just got up and left without saying anything. Now, I bring this up because, again, this is a firsthand account, so this is not something I read about. And interestingly, this guy went on to have a strong professional career publishing many articles and books on the benefits of Marxism and how the Soviet Union is morally superior to the United States. So, philosophical ideas have power, and they can impact the lives and deaths literally of millions of people. Now, let's move on to the second area I want to discuss, law. I was also very surprised to see how the philosophy of law, there's a philosophy underneath our legal system. And the biggest area is the issue of law and morality. And I'm going to cover moral philosophy toward the end of the episode. But considering the law, many people call natural law as the intersection of the two. And there's a history here. This is what I want to discuss first. Aristotle distinguished between natural justice and political justice. He claimed that natural justice was valid everywhere, but political justice just came from people's opinions. Now, one of the first prominent philosophers to discuss natural law in a major way was Catholic theologian and philosopher Thomas Aquinas. He was born in Italy in 1225, and his principal work, Summa Theologica, is considered the gold standard for scholastic medieval Christian philosophy. And although, as I said, aspects of natural law could be seen in Aristotle, as well as the Roman philosopher Cicero, it was Aquinas who really laid the foundation for the concept. He identified four types of law: eternal law, divine law, natural law, and human law. The first, eternal law, refers to God's laws alone and the laws of creation and the universe itself. The second, divine law, refers to the Bible and God's interaction with human beings. The third, natural law, which we're talking about, refers to what people were instructed to do by God through the light of reason. It was the reason implanted in people by God that allowed them to know what was right to do and what was evil. And natural law, according to Aquinas, applied to all humankind and it is unchanging. The fourth type, human law, regards specific laws that are applied by a government to regulate society. And these are obviously subject to change given local circumstances. However, importantly, Aquinas firmly believed that humans were not bound by human laws if they went against natural law. So natural law always takes precedent over human law. human laws, just a refinement, if you will, tweaking of natural laws to make them fit a particular society at a particular point in time. Now, he felt human law was necessary because people tended to have their own self-interests, and government is needed to establish the common good. Now, modern legal theory, which is primarily based on natural law, took shape in the Enlightenment, and importantly, was used to fight against the divine right of kings and establish legal rights for the individual. And today, the phrase natural law has become closely associated with the term natural rights. And this is a key component of the Declaration of Independence in the United States and many other countries and organizations, including the United Nations. And this was famously captured, this phrase was famously captured in the U.S. Declaration of Independence, in which the second paragraph of that document states, quote, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness," end quote. And natural law and natural rights are still cited today in cases argued before the Supreme Court of the United States. And there is one opposing view, though, to natural law and natural right, and we'll talk about that. That's called legal positivism. And that view holds that laws should be a function of the social needs of the time, and they're not timeless, and they're not natural. It views laws as needing adjustment due to changing definitions of morality. For example, there used to be laws against homosexual behavior due to claimed morality reasons. And morality, legal positivists note, is often in the eye of the beholder. So they want more flexibility and don't believe that these natural laws are carved in stone. Now, the Supreme Court of the United States took this positivist view early in the 20th century. And interestingly, scholars have taken different points of view of this regarding Hegel. And most seem to believe that he did advocate natural law in an abstract sense, particularly regarding rationality and free will. But he also believed that it had to be adapted to the specific laws of the state in a more positive position. So he was sort of a compromise there, a sublation, if you will. And one can easily see that the law society established can have life and death consequences for the individuals living in the state, such as the death penalty and draft into military service. So ask yourself, do you believe in natural law or legal positivism or some combination, as Hegel appears to have taken? And this question is very relevant today, because how one sees this trade-off can directly impact how one views the U.S. Constitution. And in today, there are three ways to look at it. First, there are the originalists that hold that the founders intended what they meant at the time it was put together, and that's what we should base it on, what they intended at the time. The next are the textualists, and they believe that we should put more meaning on the thought behind what was originally said and how that meaning would be applied in today's circumstances. And the third is what's called living constitutionalists, who contend that the Constitution should be periodically updated like a living document based on what society needs today. And all three elements are currently alive and well. Now, the 60s and 70s saw a swing toward living constitutionalism, and then the pendulum swung, and the 1980s saw a reemergence of textualism and originalism. So we've seen that philosophers were the ones that set down the principles underlining our judicial system, and the debates surrounding these continue today. Now on to the third area, science. Regular listeners know that I've covered the philosophy behind science many times in the podcast, particularly in episode 62 on Thomas Kuhn's work, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions. In this book, Kuhn revolutionized how scientists view their own profession. In it, he argued clearly that science does not show steady progress in knowledge, but clings to one specific paradigm, as he called it, coining the phrase, until anomalies are found, and eventually the old paradigm is thrown out and a new one adopted. As I've said many times, I believe we're currently living under a paradigm, a scientific paradigm, that all things have a material basis, meaning they can be reduced to protons, neutrons, electrons, subatomic particles, and that the movement of these material objects obey laws of nature, which can be discovered, and there's a real world out there, and it's unaffected by us at all. Now, Over the last 100 years, though, with quantum physics, certain anomalies have been discovered with this paradigm. In short, the laws of the micro world of quantum physics of subatomic particles are different than the laws of the macro world we see about them, and we can't get them to mesh. Particularly in quantum mechanics, the act of observing the micro world and measuring it seems to play a role in its actual manifestation. In other words, the observer, the measurer, cannot be separated from the observed or the measured. And this has resulted in a big question mark currently in science, and it is why scientists are still searching for the underlying theory that will explain the micro and the macro in one understanding. Now, how does science relate to the issue of life and death? Well, let's take a look at J. Robert Oppenheimer, the inventor of the atomic bomb, or the guy that led the team that created the atomic bomb. Clearly, this is one of the greatest most consequential scientific inventions ever. And that's because it has the potential to destroy all of humanity in a matter of minutes. Now, what was the philosophical position that justified these scientists in pursuing the development of the atomic bomb? It's clear from all available evidence that the decision to pursue the bomb was a direct result of the situation the U.S. found itself during World War II. The Manhattan Project, as it's been called, began after President Franklin Delano Roosevelt received a letter from Albert Einstein in 1939 outlining how such a bomb could be made, and importantly, that he believed the German government was working on such a bomb, and if they got it, it would be curtains. So he urged the president to do likewise, to start a project, and Roosevelt did. And as we all know, it became a weapon worse than anything that came before or anything that could be imagined before, and science was responsible. Now, I've not seen the new Christopher Nolan movie Oppenheimer. Here, it's really good. But I have been able to read up on his changing views about his project here. Initially, Oppenheimer was pleased that it had been made and even proclaimed that his only regret was that it wasn't developed earlier to be used against Germany. And on observation of the one test that they did before it was used on Japan, he quoted a passage from the Hindu Bhagavad Gita. He claimed, quote, "If the radiance of 1,000 suns were to burst into the sky, that would be like the splendor of the Mighty One. I am become death, the shatterer of worlds," end quote. Now, after the second use of the bomb against Japan, Oppenheimer began to have serious regrets, and he even went to a meeting after that with President Harry Truman at the time and expressed his feelings. He stated, quote, "Mr. President, I feel I have blood on my hands," end quote. And he later stated, quote, "In some sort of crude sense, which no vulgarity, no humor, no overstatements can quite extinguish, the physicists have known sin, and this is a knowledge which they cannot lose," end quote. So, the inventor of the atomic bomb saw this as a sin. Now, of course, hindsight is always 20/20, and there are a few points worth mentioning here. First, Germany was thoroughly defeated without the use of the atomic bomb. And also, there's a persuasive case to be made that Japan was on the verge of surrendering when the atomic bombs were dropped, and that it was actually the results of the massive firebombing that both preceded the A-bomb droppings and continued after it. That caused the Emperor of Japan to surrender after witnessing firsthand the destruction of the firebombing, not the destruction caused by the atomic bombs. This is vividly accounted for in the recent book, The Bomber Mafia, by Malcolm Gladwell. Now, historians will continue to sort this out, but in the world we live today, under the threat of nuclear war, this was brought about through scientific means, which underscores that science is but a tool and is up to the ones that use the tool to make the correct decisions. And this is where philosophy comes in. Now, this brings me to the last section of the talk, moral philosophy in matters of life and death. And this is a huge topic with many subcategories. I'm just going to touch on a few of the biggest ones that touch on life and death. These include questions surrounding abortion and whether it should be allowed up to just before birth or to be restricted before the baby can live outside the womb on its own or outlawed entirely. Another issue is euthanasia. Assisted suicide is now legal in some countries and in some states in America. And just what are the justified conditions for such an act? Well, that's a matter of moral judgment. The moral justification for the death penalty is another one. And environmentalists who deal with questions regarding just what our responsibilities to future generations regarding our current carbon emissions that can lead to increased global warming, which can bring about death through increased natural disasters. That's an issue as well. So there are many, many moral issues that we have to deal with in all these areas. And again, my point here is not to argue them, but just to say that they're there. And we need to think about these things and fight for the side that we believe in and provide reason to bring to these arguments. So, to summarize, I've attempted to show here that philosophy is not just a parlor game. It's not just contemplating one's navel. I hope to have shown that philosophical positions underlie important life and death issues in all aspects of life, including political, legal, scientific, and moral. And also that it is up to all of us not just to accept the status quo, but to use our efforts to actively support whatever position we take on these questions to make a difference, as Steve Jobs said. So that's a wrap for this episode. Once again, thanks so much for listening to the Cunning of Geist podcast. And just one more thing I would like to bring up. For the first few years of doing this podcast, I was producing them every other week, every 2 weeks. And then after a couple of years, they were coming out more like every 3 weeks. And recently, it's been about every 4 weeks. Now, this is my 75th episode, so I've covered a lot of ground, not only Hegel, but we've gotten into psychology, Jungian psychology, Marshall McLuhan, and so many other people. And my feeling is I only want to do a new episode when I have something to say. And I don't want to just get in front of the microphone and babble every 2 weeks. So that's my philosophy in doing these podcasts. And so the timing of the episodes will continue to be fluid and not on a fixed schedule. Now, one thing's important, though. I'm certainly posting much more content almost daily on the podcast Facebook page, at Cunning of Geist. So please check that out. And I will be supplying references for this episode on that page in a few days. So be sure to go there, visit it, like it, follow it, and engage in conversation there. Please provide your comments so we can talk things over. I really value your input. And by the way, the input I've gotten from listeners has been extremely helpful in producing these episodes. I'm also on Twitter and LinkedIn. And as I always say, please be sure to share links to this episode on your own social media and tell your like-minded friends about the podcast. Working together, we can continue to build the audience and see the ideas we share here grow. So for now, let me sign off by saying, I'm Gregory Novak. This is the Cunning of Geist podcast. See you next time.